It's okay. We're going good. All right. Well, welcome to the Winners and Losers radio program on Enlightened Radio, www.enlightenedradio.org. And you can always find our player at player.enlightenedradio.org. And today we're talking to Peggy McGowan, who's the new, I believe, is it director, right, of the Contemporary American...
Artistic director.
Artistic director of the Contemporary American Theater Festival. Certainly a star of Shepherdstown for many years. And when did you take over as artistic director? I remember I had Ed Herendeen on the show a number of years ago, a couple times. And are you succeeding? Did he retire, actually? Is that what happened?
Yes, yes. So I have been the artistic director for about 2 years, roughly. He retired in the fall of our last season, last summer.
Right. Well, it was boy, what a run over the years. It's been really something else. I was reviewing the calendar and the schedule of plays that were. Is it over yet? Is the festival over yet?
No, we have the rest of this weekend and
right.
One more week.
Okay. It was kind of interesting to me. We had a discussion actually last week because there was a little mess up with getting the schedule done last week. But it seemed to me that the plays. Can you tell me a little bit about what the theme? If you had a thematic vision, you know, for the plays that are this year, if they come together in some fashion, I'd like to hear your. View on that. We were talking about it last week, but we hadn't actually seen the plays. We'd seen the descriptions of each one, but and we hadn't seen them yet. And so give me your thought on what the theme is and anything else that you want to highlight about it.
So I did not go into the selection of the plays with a theme in mind. I didn't have sort of a checklist of things that I was looking for in the plays. So I really didn't think about how one connected to the other as I was selecting them. Of course, I'm sure in my subconscious and also just in the sort of nature of what is happening in the world today and what writers are writing about, I think as I look at them now, I can clearly see strong intersections and connections between them, but I certainly didn't go into it looking for those things. And so it is always interesting when we look at a season after the plays have been selected, how they talk to one another, and we don't really plan that.
Right, that's an evolving phenomenon. Well, for example, I was looking at the play about where the meeting is. The people meet remotely outside of their ordinary lives, and turns out that secrets have been withheld, and there's unknown things, even though that the relationship's been going on a long time. That one actually seemed like almost the most a great framework for a great story. And I was wondering, and then of course we were having dinner with some people at Alma B's last week, and who had seen all the plays because they come up here every year to see them, and they highlighted that one as, I don't remember quite the name, but I don't have the brochure in front of me.
It's Fever Dreams of Animals on the Verge of Extinction, I think.
Right, right. And tell me about that play.
So that play is written by Jeffrey Lieber. He is the co-creator of the TV series Lost and has been primarily in his recent career working in television and film. And so this is one of his first plays coming back to do some writing for the theater. And when he wrote it, he had specifically wanted Susan Booth to direct it because they have been longtime collaborators.
Right.
And Susan Booth is the artistic director at the Goodman Theater in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So the Goodman Theater has a reading series of new plays, and I went to see the reading of this play. And afterwards, I thought to myself, oh, I'd like to produce that play, but I bet the Goodman's going to do it. It's on their reading series. Susan directed the reading.
Right.
Da, 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 da. And so I started talking to Susan about it, and she said, I can't program it in my upcoming season because I already have the season slated. She said, if you want to do it and I can direct it, that would be great. Mm-hmm. And let's try and work out my schedule. And so that's how that play came to us.
Interesting.
And when I saw it, one of the things that struck me about it was that it was just very well written. It was very tight. It was very sort of clear. It had some great humor in it. I think it also has some really important questions about what the truth is in our lives and how we tell the truth to each other and how we perceive truth in our relationships. And I just felt like it was a play that we should do.
Right. I'm not surprised that, because it seemed like it had all the ingredients of a lot of, you know, dramatic surprises and kind of, it was a good framework. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me. The mm-hmm. other one that struck me and which is very interesting to me because I've been doing some programming with the new, you know, AI chatbots, and the idea of having an AI partner that was going to take care of you. That seemed to be an important theme to explore right now, since we're appear to be confronted with a challenge of artificial intelligence. How did that one develop, and how did you like the way that turned out?
So Jose Rivera wrote that play, and Jose has been working on it for a little while. And he would say when he first got the idea and first started writing on it, it seemed like it was more in the future to him. But now, given where we are in all of the robotics and AI and entity work, you know, it's not so futuristic. And so many people have sort of asked me about whether it's science fiction-y, and it is not in any way like that.
Right.
It is very much the relationship between this AI entity and this woman, and it's very human. And one of the things that is a premise of a play is that the AI entity is learning human behavior and modeling human behavior, which is very prevalent in robotic study today.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see sort of the development of this relationship and what it means to both of the characters. And so it's a really touching kind of story of how people
right
come to care for one another.
And the I think that, you know, the AI entities that are being sort of developed, it's probably because they're able to respond, you know, in a more human-like way than before, and who knows how much improved that will be. It opens that possibility for an actual relationship with a machine. And in a sense, an AI model or a system is actually, in my view, a social entity, okay? Because it's really composed literally billions of inputs and as it's being trained. And these are mostly human inputs of different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
So that you would, be looking at kind of a composite human personality or a human thing, and it opens the door to that kind of a story. I was Do you think it worked well? How did the audience react to it?
Well, so far, I think that most of the audiences have really responded to that play because it is a story that is very human and very connected, and that everyone really can associate with in some way. And it is amazingly well performed by these two actors, and it is also Jose's sort of lyrical, poetic language too. Mm-hmm. So in general, I think audiences are responding very positively to the story.
What about the you had another story here, I believe it's the Overview Effect, which is you call it a showdown between competing space companies. What was the dramatic development in that play?
So that story is actually set in the context of that situation, and we enter the story watching these two competing companies launching rockets, and of course one of them explodes in the launch process. And so that CEO hires an air disaster investigator to find out what happened because he believes it's sabotage. Mm-hmm. So this is really the story of the air disaster investigator and her journey, you know, sort of searching through the suspects and trying to decide what has happened here. But also, she has lost her parents in an air disaster that was never explained. Mm-hmm. And so part of this is a parallel journey of being able to understand the death of her parents and letting go of that and dealing with grief and reconnecting with humans, right? Mm-hmm. Reconnecting with the people around her. And so it's really her journey, and it's really her exploration of her own understanding of life.
You know, in the past, there have been a number of plays produced at CITF that later became major motion pictures or went on to other be performed in other venues as well. That kind of, I guess we would call that kind of viral thing if it actually happened in my computer background. Do you have any expectations that the plays from this season would, take that path? And or do you have any sense of that at all from having watched the ones that might be?
Well, I know that some of them are moving already. So Spiritus, Virgil's Dance, which is the piece by Dale Orlander Smith, is slated to go to New York in the, I think in February, to Rattlestick Theater, and then we'll go to Merrimack Repertory in Lowell, Massachusetts in April, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so that play already has two additional productions, and that play will go everywhere, I think, because I don't think people understand that Dale Orlander Smith is one of the preeminent sort of icon artists in the American theater right now. And to see her work and to see, because she's also the performer in the piece, it is remarkable. And so, and it's a really wonderful play. So that show is already moving.
All right.
The other show, Redeemed, that's written by Chisa Hutchinson, has a New York performance coming up, I think, in a year. So this production is slated to also move. And I also think this will move a lot, too. And then Your Name Means Dream, which is the AI entity piece, is getting a lot of buzz. I'm receiving a lot of requests for that script, as is Fever Dreams. So I have a feeling, and I think the Goodman Theater in Chicago will do Fever Dreams. I just think they won't do it until not this season, but the next.
Right. On the Redeemed show, Now, when I was reading the description of that about a woman whose brother was murdered, and you know, she ends up confronting the murderer. That seemed to me like a play that would take really first-class acting and a first-class script to be convincing. How unusual it would be for such a meeting to take place. I doubt that in real life it takes place very often. I know it has, but that seems to be a difficult acting challenge. You could overdo it or underdo it, and it wouldn't work. Did it work?
Well, I think it works, and I think according to our audiences, you know, the feedback from the audiences has been very positive. It is not probably the story you think. So, and I don't think it's such an unusual meeting experience, especially when you look at the movement of restorative justice and restorative justice trials that are happening.
Okay.
So, the idea, though, is that the prisoner has requested that the sister come and visit him in a visitation room in the prison. And his desire is to sort of seek redemption and to let her know that he understands sort of the tragedy that he has caused. And you know, there's a real effort toward forgiveness in this. Now, mm-hmm. What you find, though, as the play unfolds, is that it's a really interesting game of strategy between the two of them about this issue of forgiveness and redemption and what is the best way to do it. And so there are twists and surprises in this that keep you really wondering who has the upper hand and what's going on here.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. So you think it really works. The audience does too. That's great.
I do.
That's great. Do you have a, maybe you shouldn't say this at this point, but do you have a favorite or favorites? I assume there's always a season where, you know, things, was there any play that just didn't quite work at all the way you hoped it would? Or are you proud of all of them?
You know, I feel that this is a season that really reflects what the theater is dedicated to doing. And one of our commitments is to provide all the resources we can for playwrights to really experience their play fully with an audience and to learn from that so that they can walk away and do rewrites and make a better script. And that when that script then goes on to other theaters, it's even better than it is here. I mean, that's the principle of doing a new play.
Right.
And so I feel very positive about the fact that we have done that this season, because I think when I look at almost all of the plays, I feel that there are moments that the playwright will revisit. I think that there mm-hmm. are moments that the playwright will edit some things. I think there are moments where the playwrights will say, oh, this is not clear. And so I think that's really important for the work that we do. And I think it's very important given the fact that we're about the only new play festival left in the country.
Really? Wow.
Most of our sort of sister new play festival was at the Humana Festival in Louisville, Kentucky at Actors Theater.
Mm-hmm.
That festival no longer exists. And that is a festival that was there for 45 years. It sent many plays to Broadway. It launched the careers of many playwrights and artists. And it's gone. It's just gone. There's a Center for New Play Development in New York that was The Lark, which also launched so many playwrights, also gone. San Diego Repertory is gone, and with it their Latinx New Play Festival. It's just, there's an endless list of new play theaters or festivals that are no longer part of the American theater.
Was this a casualty of the pandemic mostly, or other factors?
I think it is a casualty of many things, and one of which, of course, is the pandemic. I think the pandemic was probably the thing that, pushed everybody over the edge. But the challenge just has been the needed transformation of the American theater in some ways, and the sense that, you know, everything is more expensive, mm-hmm. and there's less income. And there isn't the kind of support that we used to receive federally. And it's a difficult time for the theater. And certainly the pandemic was the thing that hit people the hardest.
Yeah, sure, because it was just difficult to get people to come out to do anything, really, for mm-hmm. so long. Mm-hmm. Another issue that... I remember the on the question of people improving the play. I can't remember the name of the play. It was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It ended up as a major political intrigue story about a staffer who was advising one candidate and ended up getting sucked into the other candidate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
anyway, mm-hmm. I remember watching the play and that. I say to myself, oh my gosh, I mean, the speeches were so long, okay? It looked to me like the actors were going to have to memorize an entire book. said, how could this ever work? And then I later, I saw the movie. I can't remember the famous actor that was in it right now. But and it had been, yes, kind of as you said, the script had been trimmed down and it had been, you know, tuned and turned into a really punchy drama. I mean, a great show. It was interesting because I hadn't seen that in the play when I was watching it in Shepherdstown. But, you know, thinking back on it, I could see all the ingredients that, you know, of a really good story that he had kind of overwritten to start with. But it worked good. I think that process is without that, I mean, how would a playwright really know how to go about without testing with audiences and actors? Be difficult to know exactly how to, you know, perfect, you know, the work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, that is exactly the point. That is exactly the point, because there is no way, you know, a play is written to be heard and to be seen, and it only functions when there is an audience, right? Yeah. And so one of the things I say to the audiences all the time when I talk to them is that you are such a vital part of the process of a play, any play, even a play that has been produced and written over and over and over, you know, mm-hmm. has been performed over and over again. That interaction is what makes theater. It is a community art. It doesn't exist in any other form. And so it is the only way that a playwright can learn and craft. And, you know, when you think about a painter or a sculptor or any other fine artist, there is a point at which they literally could start over the canvas without anybody ever seeing it. But it right. doesn't work that way in the theater.
No, that's true. Speaking of the costs of production, how is CATF financed? Or through contributions or federal? Is there federal aid or how?
Yes. How it was funded and how it is now currently funded are two very different things.
Oh, my gosh.
So
gosh.
When prior to the pandemic, ticket sales made up about half of our budget, just over mm-hmm. half of our budget, and the rest was contributed income, whether that was through grants or federal grants or individual giving.
Right.
So we are not anywhere near our pre-pandemic ticket sales yet. We are better than we were last year, but we have not regained that kind of balance in our budget. So like everybody else, we are still struggling to be able to sustain ourselves through the future. And, you know, part of it is we got to figure out how to bring people back to the theater and back to the experience. And part of it is that we have to figure out a new model that helps us stay financially solvent.
Right. All right. Does the college contribute, the university contribute, obviously space and the facilities, but are they invested in it that much? I can't, it seemed to me that it was kind of like two different operations in the past.
No. So the university absolutely, and particularly prior to the pandemic, provided space for us, but we have always paid for sort of the apartments we use on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Now we are in a situation with the university in which we are paying for all of the living facilities that we use, and we will soon be moving into a place where we are paying kind of a rental fee for the use of the facilities, and we are paying a percentage of our ticket sales to them.
So
our relationship with them has shifted in a financial way.
I gotcha. Okay, I got that part. Well, it's a compared to last year, for example, I mean, you definitely feel like you're on the upswing. I know just personally that, you know, me and my wife, we're trying to get out of the house more. I mean, right, you know, but we fell into this, you know, terrible habit for 2 years in the pandemic of just not going anywhere,
mm-hmm.
right?
And
so I mean, we used to go for the when you were the preseason, it was like a little cheaper. I think it cost us
the previews.
Previews mm-hmm. about I right. think, I think it cost us $10 a player or something like that. I can't remember because the full production was a little stiff at some point for us. But it was mm-hmm. Anyway. I'm thrilled that it's on the upswing, and I hope that you can find the way to keep to sustain it. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a wonderful mm-hmm. thing. Are the actors at all affected by the current conflict with SAG-AFTRA, or no? That's all something different.
You know, many people have asked me that question. So the actors that are with us are the Equity Actors Union, which are the theater actors.
Right.
Now, many of them may also have membership in Screen Actors Guild or something else, but that does not apply to what they're doing here. So they're on a contract that is a theater union contract.
Okay.
So we didn't have any issue with that. In fact, it's not necessarily helpful to us, but it is helpful to other theaters because many actors have not been taking as much theater work because they are taking the TV and film work because it pays so much better.
Right.
And so so there are times when we just can't get the people that we would like to get here because they're staying in town to do this other work.
Right.
So now that they don't have that other work, they're much more available for the theater.
Right.
And so I think for anybody who's casting right now, could be a very good thing for the theater.
I see.
The timing did not work out for us, but for others it will be a good thing.
Well, hopefully the strike won't last a year, so you'll be you should
right.
Be, yeah.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that you had mentioned the sort of pay what you will previews that we do at the very beginning of the season. We are actually launching through the rest of the season a pay what you will opportunity in sort of rush tickets so that we can give people the opportunity throughout the season to see shows at a more accessible rate. So people should look for that because we will post when we have available seats that we can rush.
All right. That's good too. How do you feel about the challenge yourself? I mean, having taken it on here, it's a big responsibility. And are you excited about it? Or are you intimidated by it? Or how is it? Are you looking forward to the next season? And go ahead.
You know, I think that we are in a time of really significant change. I think the world feels like that. I think the American theater feels like that. And to me, that feels very exciting because I do believe that the way we operated before was not ideal, and I do feel that this opportunity to transform ourselves into a different kind of working model is really exciting and very positive. And so I am excited about the potential of change. I do think it's going to be hard. I don't think it's an easy path forward, but I think the potential for what we can be is very exciting.
I certainly hope that it is, because it's especially if you say, you know, like the so many other theaters of this type or repertory theaters are struggling, and so it seems to be, I think it would be important to keep this going, maybe inspire others to give rebirth to this kind of theater around the country too. West Shepherdstown has had, you know, a number of community theaters that have, built up, I'm sure, around the reputation of the festival. And is that also, I'm sure, took a big hit during the pandemic, but is the local play producing and performing culture coming back to, you have any sense of that?
I don't, you know, I'm not as familiar with that world in a way to know specifically. I know when I go to see plays at those theaters that it seems like their audience is returning, and they seem like they're having a good response. So I think one of the differences that is significant is in terms of the real expense of even sort of an acting company. So, you know, because we have a union contract, we have pension and health and, you know, other expectations financially that I think in the community theater world they don't encounter.
Right.
I'm sure it's still a struggle for them as it is for everybody, but at least in my experience, it looks like they're managing to come back and to do well.
All right. What is the, how is the CATF governed? I mean, for example, who do you actually, is there a board? And
Yes, there is a board of trustees. And so I, for example, my position reports to the board of trustees.
Right. But the directors and actors tend to be recruited. You must have to do that pretty like next year's program. You must be already working on that now. Is that correct?
Well, previously, when Ed was here, our schedule was such that we would really be picking the plays in December and January, and then hiring the teams, and then working through the spring to be ready in the summer. I'm really trying to move us ahead, sort of like in a calendar year. So I haven't quite been able to fully move the machine in that direction. But for example, we have two plays selected for next summer. Those directors are fairly locked in. We have some elements of those productions already signed up. So
right.
Well, I'm trying to get there. I'm trying to get us in a slightly different calendar model.
All right, right. Well, I'm kind of out of questions right now on this. I would have one other one. You know, the arts in the United States. I read this. I was just reading yesterday. I was reading, I think, Fran Drescher's speech on the challenges and that they were facing with SAG-AFTRA, and mainly over the intellectual property rights and whether or not the actors and the I suppose others and working on these productions are going to get any income from streaming or possible. And then the question, if you have AI entities that are speaking based on inputs of copyrighted material, can I just say, you know? How does those images and or performances or characters, right? How do they live? I mean, how do they be able to make a living, you know, doing what they're doing? That seems to be now, so that raises another question, one last question maybe about, are the plays here, are they filmed when you're producing, when they're being performed? And is there an electronic version of the plays that later people could watch online? Or, and then, and of course, if that happened, would the actors or directors get any benefit from that? Is that an option here in the theater scene?
So what we only do archival recordings. We do not do anything that we share publicly in terms of recording the plays. And one of the reasons that we one of the reasons that we do not share them publicly is because there is a lot of discussion right now, and it has been very challenging over the last 2 years as people move to more digital formats during the pandemic about how you pay those actors and how you reflect their intellectual property as well as the playwrights and so forth. So it is, from the theater perspective, it's a very challenging proposition right now, and certainly for us, not one that we're going to venture into right now publicly. Right. There are other things that we try to do as digital experiences, but we are not trying to share the performances as digital experiences right now. And I think until a lot of this gets resolved, we will not do that. We will do other digital things, but not that. The challenge with the streaming issue and the challenge that we're all facing right now is that there's easy access to anything on an online platform. And the answer is, how do you pay the people for this?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a big question that we haven't, I don't think any industry, film, television, theater, I don't think any of us have solved this yet.
Right, and it's clearly a big issue in the strike in Hollywood, for sure. I'm not quite sure how it's going to be sorted out. I assume that it's possible you could track, the images, the people, the digital productions in such a way, but it's, the more widespread it gets, the harder it is to do, right? I mean, what happens with platforms that are operating in Europe or Asia or all these other places? I mean, and how do you enforce any agreements without having agreements that don't exist right now? So
it's a little bit, in my mind, it's a little bit too sort of the idea of what's driving the work, right? It's also the difference between being a nonprofit or arts organization and being a commercial arts organization. Those have two very different purposes. And yet what is happening really is that kind of the nonprofit arts principle is getting swallowed in this commercial arts principle that is the online forum, and that's a big challenge.
It sure is. Well, I think that I'm going to leave it there with that challenge. I want to thank you so much for joining me this morning and having this conversation. We do this podcast, by the way, by usually the next day, and I'll send you links to it, and I hope you can. It'll help maybe publicize some of these issues. But it's been wonderful to talk to you, Peggy. I'm sorry we messed up last week somehow with the getting the invite out and everything like that. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to talk to my wife Carol, see if we can get over and see one of these plays. I really like the one about the meeting in the remote play. I kind of want to see that one. All right. Well, thank you so much. And, you know, take care. And I wish you the best of luck, you know, with reviving theater art here in Shepherdstown, or saving the country's revival of theater art. Okay.
Right.
Take care. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.